Okay, John, chapter 21, verses 1 to 14. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he showed himself in this way. Gathered there together were Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples. Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." They said to him, "We will go with you." They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Just after daybreak, Jesus stood on the beach, but the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, you have no fish, have you?" They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast your net to the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because there were so many fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on some clothes, for he was naked, and jumped into the sea. But the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, only about 100 yards off. When they had gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you have just caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore, full of large fish, 153 of them. And though there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" because they knew that it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. Now this was the third time that Jesus appeared to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. This is the word of God for the people of God.
So last summer, Ashton and I went on our motorcycles down to Lake Eufaula in Oklahoma. And it's a large human-made lake that's incredibly shallow if you've never been there. It's almost comparable to Lake of the Ozarks in terms of just sheer size, but it's so shallow and full of debris that there's really no boat traffic on most of it. And that's why we went. I thought that would be really cool to kind of go on a big lake and hang out, but it not be, really just like a giant monster truck festival, you know, which is what it sounds like if you're at Lake of the Ozarks on the weekend. You know, it's just from about 6 in the morning till about 12 at midnight, you know, Lake of the Ozarks is just a bunch of V8s all day long. And so I thought that would be cool, you know, a big peaceful lake, and it was really cool. And I even bought a fishing pole. Now, the last time I went fishing prior to this was sometime as a kid with my grandpa, because that's what you do with your grandpa. You go fishing, right? And using his fishing poles, and I don't know if I caught anything or not as a kid. I'm sure I did, and that and my grandpa caught them and handed it to me to hold, and maybe that's what I remember. I don't know. But so I bought this little compact fishing pole that fits in a little bag and can fit on my motorcycle, and I went down and we got a canoe out and we rented one and we canoed around the lake, and it was so cool because you canoe further and further out and you're still scraping stuff on the bottom of the canoe. It was so shallow. And I'd read up on it and where to fish in Lake Eufaula, or there's fishing tournaments there and where all the different types of fish hide and what kind of bait to get for them and everything else. I should have talked to Mike, but I just Googled it and tried to find it, and I didn't catch a single thing. The whole day, the first day we were there, we spent the whole day on the canoe and did not catch a single thing. I gave up as the week progressed, and we spent time on our motorcycle. We rode all around the area, about 2,500 miles in total. And as we're riding around, I even gave up and went to the catch and release pond at the KOA because I felt like I had to validate my purchase of this fishing pole, and even there I couldn't catch anything. And it wouldn't have been so bad, and I could have made excuses about the heat or the sunlight or whatever, except that a little kid with a Batman fishing pole did catch a fish at the catch-and-release pond of the KOA, and I did not, so I was not successful. The Bible is full of stories. It's what it is from beginning to end. It's a book of stories of God's people. Most of the stories are stories of things that happened that exist to remind us of what it means to be the people of God, that exists to show us what the people of God have been through and what it is that we're called to do. Other stories, like Jesus' parables, are fictional stories that are told specifically to give us an idea of what it is that God wants us to know, right? The parables are fictional, but they have a very, very real meaning. A lot of these stories that we're going to find in the next few weeks center around fishing. And fishing was a profession in the first century, a lot more commonly than it was pleasure, right? Today, most people who fish for pleasure. There's plenty of people who fish professionally, but most people who fish for pleasure. In those days, it was the other way around. But it was sort of the everyday, ordinary, blue-collar job. We think about that today. It's less so today because the plants have closed, but when I was a kid, it seemed like you walk into a room and half of them worked for Chrysler, right? Or GM or Ford, right? The same couple of big companies. And certainly out here, right, you can walk around and the same blue-collar jobs kind of exist everywhere. And these are people who work hard to make their living. And so if you talk to the people about their job, they probably know a little bit about it just because they know so many people who have done that job. So even if not everybody in Galilee fished, they all knew somebody who fished. And because of that, they were able to tell the stories of people who fished as a way to connect people to God. For the next few weeks, we're going to be exploring some of the Bible's best stories about fishing, and we're calling this series Fishing Stories. And that's exactly what it is. It's the fishing stories in the Bible, the ordinary, everyday, humdrum, blue-collar job. Now first, let's do a quick recap of everything that had happened before this moment. We'll kind of call it the New Testament in 8 minutes. So what had happened was first, Jesus had called his disciples. Now this is a really important and profound moment in the gospel, because discipleship was a path of education. When you finished your primary education, right, today we'd call that high school, you could, if you were a good enough student, if you were smart enough, ask a rabbi to become their disciple. Now, if you weren't good enough, there was a moment that came where a rabbi said to you, go and learn your father's trade. Okay? Go and learn your father's trade. And what that meant was that you weren't a good enough student to continue in your education. You weren't a good enough student to continue in your studies. So you should go back to learn your father's trade so that you can make a living for yourself and start a family. And those that happened quite young. In rabbinical texts, we have these records of these rabbis talking about in the first century how culturally, if you were 18 and weren't married, had a job in your own home, you were a deadbeat. In fact, if you didn't have any children by age 18, you were probably slacking. Because they got married as teenagers. And so as teenagers, they were sent back to learn their father's trade as they headed into adulthood. The very best students would actually go to the court called Beth Din. It means the house of religion. And they would study the Torah intensely, and they would sit in three rows. If you can imagine that maybe the court is up here, they'd be sitting in three rows. And as they progressed through their studies, they would either get sent home or they'd move up a row. And then either get sent home or they'd move up a row. And then when they were on the first row, they would either get sent home or they would actually be brought up onto the court to actually hear cases, to actually serve the role as judge, because the society had adjudicated that they were exceptional scholars in the Torah, in the law. They knew God's law so well that they could even judge cases on God's law. And then they could join a rabbi. They could join what's called the yeshiva, a group of disciples. And they would progress through their education in these groups of disciples. And in these groups, they would chat with one another, they would debate theology with one another, they would grow in their own faith, and hopefully at some point, they would become rabbis. That's the way it usually worked. Jesus did things a little bit differently, right? Jesus called, for those of you who remember, right, where did Jesus call his disciples? They were at work. I realize I'm in a room full of Methodists, so we don't talk during worship, but that's okay. They were at work, right? They were learning their father's trade. The moment had already come where a rabbi had come up to them and said to them, yeah, okay, great, but I read your last paper. Go learn your father's trade, right? I'm looking at your GPA here. Go learn your father's trade. Your best bet is to quit school because you're not doing very well and go learn a trade so that you can earn a living for your family, right? These kids, these teenagers, had already experienced a rejection because they weren't good enough, and Jesus Christ, Son of the living God, came to them and said, follow me, be my disciple. So this is what a disciple does, every disciple, regardless of who their rabbi is. and leave everything behind. If a student goes into the rabbi's office and says, I want to be your disciple, and the rabbi says yes, you don't even go home to tell your parents the rabbi said yes. You're done. You separate yourself from the world and you become a student. First and foremost, a student of your rabbi. Jesus' disciples were called, he didn't modify discipleship. It was the same thing. First, you are a student. You learn everything you can about the Bible and about your rabbi. The second, you submit yourself to the authority of the rabbi. Whatever the rabbi asks you to do, you do it. Because part of the role of a disciple is also to carry out the mission of the rabbi. If the rabbi is very passionate about a particular project, then the disciples are the ones who help the rabbi carry it out. The rabbi gives them instructions, and then they go do it. These instructions might be mundane and simple, like, go ahead and prepare a place for me. Or they might be, go find me a donkey, right? Sound familiar? The instructions might be more profound, like, I need you to carry on my legacy and make disciples for me, right? And the third thing was that they spread the yoke of their rabbi. That they went around, and whatever it is that their rabbi did, whatever their rabbi was passionate about, whatever their rabbi taught it, they did it, and they shared it. So Jesus' disciples, that's what they're called to do, right? That's what it is that they're being asked to do. First, to be students of Jesus, to learn everything they can about God and about Jesus and about the Bible, to submit themselves to the authority of Jesus, to do whatever it is that Jesus asks them to do, and third, to spread that yoke. Now, the reason we went through that refresher course is because I want to take you back to the story that we read this morning. In this story recorded in John's Gospel, Jesus has already died. In fact, this is the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after his death and resurrection. In this story, the discipleship was, in their minds, over. The moment where they became a rabbi never happened, and their rabbi was dead, so in their mind, it was time to go back to work. Because where did Jesus find the disciples today? He found them in a boat. That's what they did. They were fishermen. That happens to be the trade that their fathers did. They were at a boat. Peter gets up with his friends. They're all together. The disciples are figuring out different ways to deal with what they experienced, having watched Jesus die on the cross, having witnessed the death of their rabbi. Having seen this, having experienced this, having heard about this, well, heard about it because they weren't there, they were afraid. But having known this happened, some, right, Jesus found on the Emmaus Road. Remember that story where Jesus appears to the disciples, but they don't recognize him, so they chat with him on the Emmaus Road because they're getting out of town. They're leaving the city. They're leaving. They're leaving the country. Others he found locked in the upper room, right? The gospel author tells us that the room was locked. Jesus kind of walked through the walls, right? That's kind of one of the cool things he got to do after he died, right? He came back to life and he got to walk through the walls because they locked the doors. The doors were locked because they didn't want anybody else in. The doors were locked because they were afraid. Each of them in their own way was trying to figure out how to survive in a world that clearly was against them. Peter's response was to go to work. So his friends are with him, and Peter says, I'm going to go fishing. Now, they often fished at night, and they often fished at night because of the weather. Different times of year, different times of the day is when storms came. So this time of year, right, there's worried about daytime spring storms, and so they're heading out into the lake in the evening. And they get on the boat and they fish and they fish and they fish and they fish and they fish. Hours and hours and hours go by. They fish and hours go by and they catch absolutely nothing. Here's the thing about first century fishermen. Many of them didn't own their own boat, especially at a young age. They rented it. They paid someone for it. And even if they did own their own boat, there were upkeep expenses. There were expenses for supplies. And so there was cost of doing business, right? Business majors in the room, cost of doing business, right? There's a cost to make money. It takes money, right? So there's a cost of doing business. And if you don't catch anything, that means that you have no revenue. Now, I did not go to business school, but I think I have this right, that if you have expenses and no revenue, then that means you lost money, right? Yeah, good, okay. So we got that. So this is not good. When you have money and you have expenses and you lose money, that's really a problem. So what this means is that we're not going to eat, we're not going to feed our families, we're going to be in debt. This is a bad, bad day. So Jesus shows up. Jesus could have done a lot of things. Jesus could have come through the clouds like Elijah, billowing clouds and thunder and bright lights. Jesus could have even done what his dad did at his own baptism, right? Right? Jesus' dad, God, outdid every other dad ever, Right? Forget loud clapping or jumping up to take the picture. He came out of the clouds and in a booming voice the world heard, said, "This is my son. Check out, that's my boy," right? Jesus doesn't do any of that. Jesus just kind of walks on the shore, right? He's risen from the dead. This is pretty extraordinary stuff. This is not just another day. But he walks on the shore. He's got a sense of humor. He waits all night. Right? He could have appeared at any time. He waits. He lets them fish all night. Maybe he's a little bit mad at them for deciding to go back to their father's trade and give up on the discipleship. I don't know. But he waits all night, and he goes to the shore. He sees them coming back to the shore. He says, "Hey, children, cast your net on the other side." And they do it. They throw it on the other side. They throw their net. This is from VBS last year that we used, the net we used to tell this story, actually. And I thought I'd bring it out for us. And so they toss the net on the other side. And they pull up such a huge load of fish. They're near the shore. They're in shallow water, kind of like the lake you follow, right? They're in shallow water at this point. They have to get out of the boat and drag the net onto shore. And when they get there, Jesus has cooked them breakfast. He says, "Bring some of that fish over here." This is an incredible story. When a disciple wasn't good enough, when their theology wasn't strong enough, when their answers weren't convincing enough, when their command of the Torah was not sufficient enough, when they weren't enough, they were told to go back and learn a trade. Jesus finds them back at their trade, which they're evidently not very good at because they just spent the last 2 years not learning their trade. They just spent the last 2 years doing something other than learning this trade, and now they have to figure it out because they're really too old. Now it's time for them to actually start making a life for themselves, right? Things have changed a lot. 15, 16, 17 years old, they're grown-ups. They need to start doing something with their life. "Bring some fish over," says Jesus. "Let's have breakfast." So here's our first fishing story. It's the story of students who got a second chance and thought they had lost it, who found a rabbi so extraordinarily gracious that he didn't pick them from among the Ivy League. He didn't pick them from among the magna cum laude, but from among the humble blue-collar kids who just wanted to take care of their families. And that rabbi's yoke was so extraordinarily controversial because it placed grace above the law that it got him killed. What do you hear in the story? Whose voices do you hear? I hear the voice of every rejected, forgotten, defeated, or broken soul who once had a dream and found it crushed into pieces as they limped home to give up and to be only as great as everyone else told them they could be. I hear the voice of every hard-working laborer who gets joy from working with their hands to put food on the table but feels increasingly rejected by a culture that only appreciates the contributions of those who wear a tie to work. You hear the voices of everyone who ever thought God was going to use them for something amazing, and time again they tried, and time again they failed. If those are the voices you hear, then I want you to pay attention to where in this story Jesus was. Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God, had conquered death, had died, and was alive again, did not reject them. He didn't come back and say to the schools, "Hey, I get the best pick of the students because clearly I'm some kind of rabbi if I can come back to life." Right? He didn't do that. He went right back to the people he called. He went right back to where they were. He showed up at their work. He showed up at the factory. He showed up at the classroom. He showed up at the cubicle. He showed up at their job. He said, "I'm still ready to do something with you. I'm still ready to use you. I'm still ready to change the world with your help." Jesus met them where they are, spoke to them in a language they understood, broke bread with his friends. Even if they had resolved that it was time to move on, Jesus wasn't done with them yet. The story of Peter's big catch is a story for everyone who has ever felt that it's too late to make a difference. It's a story for everyone who has ever felt that God can't use them right where they are. If you've ever felt that way, know that Jesus is waiting at the shore. Maybe with a kettle of fish and some bread, or like I said in VBS, we got to tell this story and we used goldfish crackers and pita bread. And so I realized that I should have maybe explained it better when a kid saw me at a restaurant a couple months later and said, "I remember you. You told us the time that Jesus gave goldfish crackers to his friends." Close enough. I mean, you get the point, right? I remember that we had this net as decoration, but I actually used a little bitty fishing net, and we scooped up some goldfish crackers out of a bucket that we hid on the other side of the boat. Don't tell the kids, they thought it was water. But, we had the goldfish crackers out of the water. Whatever it is that we use, though, the idea is the same. The story is that Jesus Christ met his people where they are, loved them, cared for them, broke bread with them, and changed their lives forever. This also puts a profound emphasis on our call from God to make disciples. How are we doing on that? What we are not called to do is to get people to sit in the pews and write checks to fund us. What we are not called to do is fill the pews so that it feels like it used to feel, because, folks, those days are probably never coming back. They never do. I just came back from annual conference, and one of the things that our bishop talked about was the decline of the church, which, as long as I've been alive, has been the discussion. And he talks about coming into ministry in 1979, which was a long time ago, right? It was 20 years before I was born. And, 11 years before I was born. And so he talks about that. He talks about how, one of the things that he's a very plain-spoken guy. I've told you that before. He's from Southeast Missouri. He says, I've been on a sinking ship since 1979. At least that's what everyone keeps telling him. Because when he was a kid, they talked about the good old days. And so then he says, as a bishop, he goes around to all these churches, and he visits all these churches, and every single church tells him the same thing. I can't remember when, and his response is always the same. I can't. It wasn't like that when I was a kid. The truth is, actually, the decline of the church began in 1860. And we have some folks in this church who have been around for a long time. I don't think we have anybody in this church who's been around since 1860. So there's nobody in this church who's been alive during a period of time where the church was growing. Maybe our local church as it waxes and wanes, but the church as a whole, big C, Christianity, no one in this room has been alive when that's been growing. So we become defeated, and we think that there's nothing left to do in the church because it isn't as great as it once was. And instead of looking forward to how it can be great in the future, we look back at how it was once great, and we just wish it was that way again. What if instead we looked at it as the model of discipleship? That no matter how terrifying it gets, we don't give up and go back to the fishing boat. No matter how useless we feel or how much we feel like we're not doing what we once did, we don't just go back and learn a trade. We continue on this path of discipleship, this path that invites and brings people to become students, to submit to the authority of Jesus Christ, and to spread the yoke of the gospel. Friends, Jesus is at the shore. What he's asking is for you to toss the net. If you think you've gone too far to be used by God, toss the net and see what you find. If you think you're too old or too young to be used by God, toss the net and see what you find. If you think that you're too smart or too dumb or too well-educated or too poorly educated to be used by God, toss that net. If you think that God is calling you and that because God is calling you, he must have the wrong number, toss the net. God's going to use us because God is using this church every single day in all of the amazing ways we experience new and vibrant ministry here in this church. I have to confess, when I hear, and I hear it every week, I hear it almost every day, how good things used to be before I was even alive, right? How good things used to be. It bothers me because I can't believe how good things are now. Maybe it's because I wasn't alive in the 60s when everything was perfect and nobody ever had any problems, according to what I'm told. But things are going really great now. It's amazing the stuff that we're doing in this church. It's amazing what these people around you in this room are accomplishing in God's name. If we celebrate that, rather than worrying about what maybe once was great, I don't know, I wasn't there. Like I said, I wasn't even alive. But if we celebrate that, maybe we can get ourselves back onto an understanding of discipleship. Because the disciples were always disciples, they never became rabbis because they weren't intended to. They had their one last rabbi, that was Jesus. Their job from then on forevermore was to make more disciples for their rabbi. And that's our job too. Our mission in the Missouri Conference is to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world. That means is that we invite people in, we encourage people in, not to fund our programs or fill our pews. We hope that they do that too, but our job as Christians is to dive them into the study of God, to encourage them to submit themselves to the authority of their rabbi, Jesus Christ, and to spread the yoke of the gospel. That last one's the really hard part. Because that yoke was the yoke that went into a world who said those people are poor because they didn't do the right things or because they sinned or because their families were bad. And Jesus said, I don't care. My job is to meet their needs. He went into a world where the people said they were diseased because God is punishing them. Jesus says, no, they're not. And he healed them. Jesus went into a world that constantly told people that if anything was wrong with their lives, it was their own fault, because then it made themselves feel better about their own lives. And Jesus said, no, God's people love everybody. God's people are called to heal, to touch, and to love everybody. So that's what we need to do. In a few minutes, we're going to leave this sanctuary, and in a few minutes, it'll be your turn to spread the yoke of your rabbi. So go from this place to love and to serve the Lord, and do so by meeting the people where they are. Don't expect them to come to you. One of the stories that our bishop told during annual conference that he's told a couple of times is the story of his mother and being in church with her. And as he was going through seminary and he was heading towards ministry and he was reading all about the doctrine of the church because he thought it was just his church. And then he got to seminary and realized it was every church. And it's been every church for 100 years. And so he begins to read about this and he says, Mom, why aren't you inviting people to church? And his mom says, well, everybody I know goes to church. So the bishop's response as a kid, it's, well, 18, 19-year-old, looks at his mom and he says, well, Mom, why don't you get some new friends? Indeed, we can't wait for them to come to us. That's not how discipleship works. We have to go out. Jesus and the disciples traveled the world. They left their families behind. And maybe we're not being called to that. I sure hope I'm not, because that would be scary. But we are certainly called to go out into our community, to reach out to those people, to share with them the love of God and the love of neighbor, to love them, to break bread with them, to find out what it is that they need and to meet that need in the best of our abilities, and to invite them into the fold of your rabbi. Now, I wouldn't suggest using the big Hebrew words like yeshiva and Beit Midrash. That'll just scare people, right? Also, I'm probably mispronouncing them, so that'll make it even worse. But invite them, love them, and make disciples of Jesus Christ so that together we right here in St. Clair can continue to transform the world. Amen.